Okay, so. Okay, Jaya. Crash course Jaya Stellar Oscillation Code, jolly good. Right, first things first, what does Jaya actually do? So Jaya considers small, three-dimensional, non-axisymmetric perturbations to an equilibrium stellar state. So it basically models how a star can depart from equilibrium, hydrostatic, thermal, in small amplitude perturbations, and perturbations in particular that happen to be periodic, or can be written as e to the I times some frequency times time. So basically, these perturbations take the general form given by these equations here. The radial displacement perturbation is some function of radius times a spherical harmonic times an exponential time term. The horizontal displacement perturbation has a similar form, but it's the horizontal gradient of a spherical harmonic. And then any general perturbed quantity, let's say the density perturbation, the pressure perturbation, can be written again as some function of radius only times a spherical harmonic, function of theta and phi, and it's got integer indices, m and l, then times an exponential time dependence. So these basically are the general form for separable solutions to the pulsation equations, and the pulsation equations are just the perturbed conservation equations governing fluids, you know, mass, continuity, momentum conservation. And now, generally speaking, even though we can write down general solutions in this form, it's only a discrete set of those solutions which will actually satisfy appropriate boundary conditions at the center of the star and at the surface. And these discrete solutions occur at specific frequencies, which we call the eigenfrequencies of the star. It's basically the normal modes of oscillation of the star. So there's a discrete set of frequencies which define the eigenfrequencies of the star, which are the frequencies at which we can find solutions actually satisfying all equations and boundary conditions. And then associated with each eigenfrequency is a set of eigenfunctions, functions of radius alone, which are these unknown functions here that we have to solve for as well somehow. So Jaya does this for you. You give Jaya a stellar model, for instance, a model produced by MESOR, it can deal with polytropes, and it'll tell you what the eigenfrequencies are for a given value of the spherical harmonic M and L. So these are instructions on how to install Jaya. I assume all of you have at least got through to some part through the test. If the test is still running, you can stop it now. And the one thing you'll want to do is set the Jaya underscore DIR environment variable to point to the top-level directory where you install Jaya, so the directory called Jaya. Shall I carry on? Okay.
No.
Okay. Yeah, if you're using the seashell, then you deserve everything you get. That end will work as well, but you'll have to ditch the equal sign.
What does minus j come make?
Minus j basically says launch as many threads when doing the make as you need. Without any number, it can potentially use 2 gajillion processors, even if your machine only has 2 of them. It'll just launch loads and loads of jobs. But usually with Jaya, it never ends up using up more than the available processors. So that's not a problem. Bill, are you with us?
How do I test that I've actually correctly set gyre? I say echo dollar gyre here.
Echo dollar gyre, yeah.
And I get back an empty string. So, oh no, there it is.
Okay.
Yes.
Right, let's press on then.
Great. Sorry.
Right, what we're going to do is we're going to run a test problem. We're going to make a little working directory in the top level gyre directory. Grab a stellar model, grab a Jaya input file, and then run Jaya. And then after we've got jar running, we're going to go through the output produced by this invocation at the bottom, and we'll discuss how the input file produces that output. And then that'll be it. It's a MESA model for an SPB star that comes bundled with jar as part of the that I use for testing. Okay. So it's like a 4.5 or 5 stellar mass mid B type star.
And they are pulsating.
Yes.
Okay, nice. And should we run this up now?
Yeah, absolutely. That sounds promising. In the input file, I think we've asked for 3 different values of L, so it'll do it 3 times. It basically goes through that sequence for each combination of L and M you ask for. That's what we're going to go through in a moment.
Now all your passwords are safely transferred.
That's right.
Rich now owns all of your passwords.
Right, we're ready to move on and actually discuss that screen full of output that you saw?
Yes.
Okay. So, you might want to scroll back through the output or run it again and pipe it to the less command, or because we're going to go through this sort of bit by bit. So the very first thing Jaya spits out is the version number, and you are using version 5, which is the latest, greatest, and completely unreleased and undocumented version. I would have released it a year ago had I actually been able to write a manual for it, but that's still a work in progress. Then Jaya just tells you how many threads it's running with, because it uses multiple threads, on hopefully running on the multiple cores in your computer, and it tells you what input file it's running from. And it's running from jar.in, because that's what we told it on the command line to use. Okay, so that's pretty obvious. Okay, after initialization, the very first thing Jaya does is it reads in that stellar model, that spb.mesa file. So this tells us which file it reads from. There are different versions of this MESA file format that Jaya reads in. When it says reading from MESA file, what it means is it's reading in a file that was created by MESA explicitly for use with Jaya. This is a version 1 MESA file. It contains 1814 points specifying the temperature, pressure, everything, Brunt-Weissler frequency between the center and the surface. And Jaya tries to repair any obvious defects in the model. If the center's missing, it'll create a center. It can sometimes fix up the Brunt-Weissler frequency at density discontinuities if that's ropey. It tries to do sensible things.
Did MESA star create spb.mesa?
It did,
and
yes.
What magical incantations do you give it?
All you do is you tell it that the output format for pulsation data is Jaya.
Does it do voice recognition?
No. So you put that in the inlist file. You put that in the control inlist controls.
What was the point? 1814 points in there. What does it mean?
That's the number of points in the stellar model.
So in the stellar model.
Yes.
The model already existed. We copied it, and it
yes.
Was that amount of zones.
That's right. Yes.
Okay.
Yes. Yeah? Okay. This is a MESA, a Jaya tutorial, not a MESA one.
Peace, but I have to make the goddamn model.
Yeah.
And you haven't told me explicitly in the notes what I put in my control file. You're
wait, because it's in the MESA documentation.
There is no MESA documentation.
Yes, there is. There's the annotated inlist. There's not time to teach you how to get MESA to do it. I can tell you that some other time. I'll send you an email. Okay. Okay, look. when do you want the model?
The two of us should not be allowed in the same
Do you want it at every time there's a profile written out?
No.
Or at the end of the run?
I just wanted that at least once.
Okay, I'll just sketch that out. Ha ha. I'm probably going to get the actual name of the controls wrong, but you know, I'm approximating here.
Okay, thanks very much.
What's the first one? Is it star? It's star. Star job, that's it.
That I know. It's the name of this magical thing that you added.
No, you added it.
I did.
I've had to tidy it up.
Wait, this is what we should put in the mixer?
Yeah. It's probably wrong.
So the model that you sent to Jair is not a normal model we made up.
That's correct.
It has to be written in a specific format that's designed for use by some. MESA can write out formats that are designed for use with pulsation codes, and they're slightly different than MESA's standard profile or .mod file.
Okay, so this is not a .mod file.
This is not a .mod file. So you tell it to, when it terminates, to, again, these might not be the exact commands, but they're approximations. You tell it to write a pulsation data file. When it terminates, that gives the file name. But to actually say what format to write that file in controls, there's something called pulse data format.
Things go into star job, some things go into controls.
Not always clear to me. I've forgotten.
Okay. So the magic parameter to add in controls is pulse data format equals gyre in uppercase. And that's what was used to create this file, sbb.mesa.
Thank you.
If the format hasn't changed, we'd get us some cool lectures on using MESA to build in the basis strip of P-stars. And so all of that should be in that documentation of the summer school.
Okay.
So,
yeah. Yes.
Okay. Now when you put this in MESA, when is it going to give you the pulsation model? Because MESA is evolving the star.
When it terminates.
When it terminates. So for the last model.
There are other options other than when true.
There are ways to get it out to write out a pulsation model whenever it writes out a profile. But this is just to write out the pulsation model for the final model of the MESA run.
Ah, okay. So we can get also for like every profile.
Yeah. In fact, there's ways to run MESA without actually writing out a pulsation model, but running gyre at each time step and doing something with the results. So that's typically used for automated astroseismology. I'm focusing really on standalone invocation today. Have I gone to the next slide? Okay. After we've loaded the model, what Jaya does is it starts searching for dipole modes with L equals 1, and that should actually, of course, be M equals 0, because... Yeah, I've duplicated it. Okay, there we go. So it's just telling you, okay, I'm going to start looking for modes with L equals 1 and M equals 0. The first thing it does is it builds a frequency scan. It searches for these modes over a certain region of frequency space, and this is actually... the range of frequencies in which it searches. I'll tell you what units those are in a couple of slides. And it also sets up the grid on the spatial grid on which it's going to actually try and solve for those radial eigenfunctions we saw a few slides ago. And we end up with adding in a few extra points and ending up with a grid which has got a total of 1842 points. So it's got some sort of automatic regridding option that will allow it to add points to the stellar model grid to create a calculation grid for finding these radial eigenfunctions. And we'll see how to control those in a... Ilva?
So this grid that you've created, is it now the stellar model, or is it like both? Because the old one had 1814,
I think so, yeah.
And now you have more. What happened here?
There are additional points that have been inserted, and spline interpolation is used to evaluate what the stellar model is at those additional points. And basically, there are some parts of the star that we only need a few points to resolve, let's say changes in the temperature and density. But if the actual eigenfunctions that are highly oscillatory, we're going to need lots more points to resolve those when we do the pulsation calculation. So that's why we end up introducing extra points.
So these are interior points?
Yeah, these are interior points. We're not changing the range of the grid. Okay, can I go on? Okay, so this is really the where Jaya tells you what it's found. This is the output. These are the results. These are eigenfrequencies. So for each mode with L equals 1 that Jaya has found, it spits out a line, and this line tells you the L value, which we already know because we told it to look for L equals 1 modes, the M value it was using. It counts up the number of nodes in these eigenfunctions and classifies them by doing a node counting exercise, but it distinguishes between nodes that are kind of associated with acoustic wave behavior and nodes that are associated with internal gravity wave behavior. So there are separate node counts, N underscore P, which is acoustic wave, and N underscore G, which is internal gravity wave. And in fact, the difference between them is used to define a generalized mode index that we hope will be a unique label of modes. And for dipole modes, we're actually guaranteed it's a unique label by work done by Masao Takada.
And just one thing. You are obviously looking for G-modes here.
Uh-huh.
And I just want to add that that's why you have the inverse in the previous...
Well, I'll be explaining that.
Okay.
Yeah. Don't worry. Now, these are the actual frequencies of the modes. They have a zero imaginary part because we're doing a purely adiabatic calculation. Things either decay exponentially with time or they oscillate with a real frequency. So the actual units of these eigenfrequencies, they're actually dimensionless. Jaya works internally in the dimensionless version of the eigenfrequency sigma, so it's basically the frequency of a mode multiplied by the dynamical timescale of the star. Gives us our dimensionless frequency, and that's what Jaya does everything internally in. Okay. Now you may say, well, why? It turns out that most of the time, G modes have dimensionless frequencies less than 1, and we can see, indeed, for all of these modes, the dimensionless frequency is less than 1, and for P modes, it's greater than 1. So it's very common when we're doing pulsation to put everything into a dimensionless form, because then the P modes and the G modes kind of live in predictable regions of frequency space. These two columns give the frequency data. This is an indication of how well the calculation converged, and it should typically be a small number on the order of 10 to the minus 12. If it's 10 to the minus 9, that's not brilliant, but that's kind of not bad. If it's 10 to the minus 323, that means you've probably got a bogus result. So if it's crazy small, that means something's gone wrong. And also if it's crazy large, that means something has gone wrong. And this is just how many iterations for each mode it took Jaya to converge to that mode.
So none of these are mixed modes?
None of these are mixed modes.
How does it look like when you have a mixed mode? And what is it?
For a mixed mode would have a non-zero NP and NG.
And that is just that these two modes have the same frequency?
It's basically, one part of the star, it looks like the mode looks like a G mode, and then another part, although at the same frequency, it looks like a P mode.
They have different acoustic waves and gravity waves, right? So you generate the G mode in the surface or so, and the P mode is like on the surface, and they just happen to oscillate at the same frequency?
Yes.
Or is it that it's sort of...
It's that they have... If you were to consider the regions they sort of inhabit independently of each other, one would be just a pure P mode and one would be a pure G mode, but they happen to have the same frequency and there's tunneling between them that allows them to exchange energy.
Same everything, like all of their...
Same idea.
Yeah. So you can spot a mixed mode because NP and NG are both simultaneously non-zero.
And what is NPG in
that case? NPG is still the difference between them, okay?
That's why you're not getting
out of okay, what we're going to do now is actually have a look at the input file that led to this run and try and understand what's going on in that. So the input file is a Fortran name list file, which is a very creaky Fortran format that quite conveniently, however, allows us to throw together a sequence of name equals value pairs and group them together in various named groups. So this nameless format is basically the same Fortran format that Mesa uses for its input files. In Jaya, there are quite a few different nameless groups, however, for grouping together sort of different parameters. There has to be at least one of every nameless group that I mention in the following slides in a file, even if they're empty. So if you actually open up the Jaya.in file and have a look at it, we'll go through it sort of chunk by chunk. So the very first thing in the nameless input file, the Jaya.in file, is just an empty constant section. This is where you would override the mass of the sun, the radius of the sun, the gravitational constant, whatever, in order to make sure that you agree in these fundamental parameters with whatever your stellar evolution code has used. Because if you start using different values for the mass of the sun, you're going to get kind of crazy results. Your star won't be quite in hydrostatic equilibrium as far as Jaya is concerned. So we don't want to override any constants, so we just leave in a blank constants name list. The next nameless group, the model nameless group, basically defines the name of the model file that we're going to read in. This is the sbb.mesa file. So firstly, model type equals evol tells us that this is an evolutionary model produced by a stellar evolution code rather than, let's say, a polytrope. File defines the file name of the model, and then we say that the file format is in the format created by Mesa. Jaya can also read other file formats like the sort of semi-standard FGONG format and the number of other pulsation codes out there, and they've got their own formats that I've tried to implement in Jaya if I want to read in a model that they've been working on. Okay? Right. Mode parameters. This is where we actually tell Jaya which oscillation modes we're going to search for, specifically which combinations of L and M we want to separately consider. You'll notice that there are multiple nameless groups. It's actually allowable in Fortran to have multiple groups for the same name, and then you can just read them in sequentially by repeated read statements. So we're saying we want to search for separately modes with L equals 1, 2, and 3. Because we don't specify M, it defaults to 0. But in any case, M doesn't make any difference until we include rotation. It's all of the eigenfrequencies are degenerate with respect to M in the absence of rotation. Just in the same way, energy levels in atoms don't depend on M, let's say the hydrogen atom, until we start worrying about spin orbit effects or things like that. Now, these tag definitions give us a way to refer to these different mode groups elsewhere in the file. So we can basically identify under which other sets of parameters we want to apply when we're running, let's say, the L equals 1 modes or the L equals 2 modes. We can restrict other groups of parameters to only actually turn on when we say, basically only use this set of parameters when you have the L equals 1 tag listed as a set of matching tags. It just gives, they can be any textual string, it just gives a way to use different parameters for different values of L, which is sometimes important. Okay? Okay. Two further nameless groups, OSC and NUM. OSC sets oscillation parameters, and this is typically where, again, it's blank now, so it's using all the defaults, but this is where you're, if you want to change the boundary conditions that are applied at the center and the surface of the star, or if you want to turn on the effects of rotation, or, for instance, if you want to include non-adiabatic effects, which will allow you to search for heat-driven modes, then the OSC name list is, group is where you would turn those things on.
If we want to try some of those things.
Uh-huh. The online documentation gives you a big list of...
If you're going to add rotation in Jaya, uh-huh. Does that not mean that the rotation needs to also be on in Mesa? Or what do you mean by turn rotation on?
So what I mean is include the effects of the Coriolis force on the pulsation. Now, whether the actual stellar model itself has rotation or not is a separate issue. It can have a finite angular velocity, and that would happen, for instance, if you did a MESA run with rotation turned on. It's also possible in the model nameless group to override any rotation profile that gets read in from disk and set it to a uniform rotation rate that you can choose arbitrarily.
So do Gyre and MESA interpret, in the case of rotation, interpret the sample values of fluid quantities in the same way?
No, they don't. So there's a regridding involved, because MESA, even though it's a finite volume code, bits of it look like finite difference in that it's got face quantities and cell quantities rather than being pure cell quantities. Yeah, but some of your differential. Cut that man up.
Yeah, okay, but
some
I was thinking.
To define the interface summary averages for the.
Sure, I understand. Okay, so I was also thinking, though, in terms of, I mean, Mason's interpreting them as cellular averages or whatever, and rotating stars. Is that the same?
In Gaia, when this pulsation file is created, they're actually converted from cellular averages into point samples.
Point samples along the equator?
There's no difference in some ways. MESA is a quasi-1D code. So I guess I don't really worry about centrifugal effects.
Everything's the equator.
Yeah.
Okay. Sorry, I don't want to derail things.
No, that's fine. So the OSC nameless group sets up oscillation parameters. NUM nameless group allows you to tweak numerical parameters. So, for instance, what scheme it's using for setting up finite differencing to solve these radial differential equations.
Just to actually answer your question as opposed to blowing it off like I did last time. In terms of a radius, it's the radius that is used in the cellular approximation, which is in between the equatorial and polar radii that you would get from distortions.
This is a pretty good standard choice for the differencing scheme. It gives a good trade-off between speed and accuracy. But I wouldn't worry too much about these parameters until you've got the sort of basic functionality in Gyre working. So to discuss the next set of parameters, which is the scan parameters, we're going to go on a complete digression. And this is where we actually learn how Gyre works. Okay? So we're considering the partial differential equation and set of boundary conditions that describe waves on a small amplitude wave, transverse waves on a clamped string. So the motion of the string, let's say y is the displacement of the string perpendicular to its extent. That displacement satisfies a wave equation, the linear wave equation, which is this. This is just the sound speed along the string, which depends on the tension of the string and the mass unit length. And then since the string is clamped to either end, let's say the string is a length L, we have two boundary conditions to apply. So if we were approaching this in the same way Gyre approaches the problem of stellar pulsations, well, first of all, we'd say, okay, let's think about periodic solutions. So we can write a general function of space and time as the product of a function of space alone times an exponential time factor. And if we substitute this trial solution into the wave equation, we've converted our partial differential equation into an ordinary differential equation governing this eigenfunction y. And you'll see that the frequency, or governing this wave function y, we'll see the frequency appears in there. Okay. Now, solutions to that ordinary differential equation down here look like this. Solutions are some arbitrary normalization, since this is a linear equation, times sine of sigma x over c. Okay. Now you'll notice that these solutions always satisfy the boundary condition that y must be 0 at x equals 0. But they only satisfy the other boundary condition that y is also 0 at x equals l when this condition is satisfied. This is the characteristic equation which basically governs the valid set of frequencies at which this string can vibrate. Okay? And the solutions of this characteristic equation are, in a sense, are in a sense the the solutions to this equation are the eigenfrequencies of the clamped string. Now, we kind of know how the sine function works. We know its zeros are located where its argument is an integer multiple of pi. Okay? But suppose we didn't really know what where the zeros of the sine function are located. What we would then say is, well, to solve this equation, we've got a root-finding problem. We have to find where some discriminant function, which is a function of sigma, vanishes. And in this case, our discriminant function is sine sigma x over c. So we've got a numerical root-finding problem. And Jaya... Let me just quickly check that this isn't an emergency. I'm in the middle of a lecture. Is it okay if I call you back?
Sorry. I sent you something. Now I need you to read
it. No, I know. I'll read it. Okay? Bye. Okay. So we've got a numerical root-finding problem. We've got to find the roots of this function d of sigma, and that will give us the eigenfrequencies of the string. Jaya has a similar approach. When it solves the radial, the ordinary differential equation governing these radial wave functions, it ends up with some discriminant function, which is a function of frequency, and it's got to find at what frequencies that discriminant function vanishes. So the standard approach for finding the roots of some black box function, d of sigma, is to evaluate the function at some sequence of frequencies. And for any given pair of frequencies, sigma I to sigma I plus 1, if the discriminant that we evaluate changes sign, we know there must be an odd number of roots of this discriminant within that interval. There can be 1, there can be 3, there can be 5. We usually hope that there's just one if we've done things right, and then we use a bisection algorithm, which gradually narrows the bracket on this root to refine down exactly where the root occurs. And there are more sophisticated ways of doing things than bisection, but bisection's pretty robust. But numerical recipes has got a nice discussion of this.
You detect if there's more than one.
Well, no, you don't.
Yeah.
If there's three, you'll find one of them. So that brings us to the question of, well, how do we choose the set of frequencies on which we make this initial scan for sign changes in the discriminant? And the rubric here is that we should ideally match a distribution of sample frequencies to have kind of the same distribution as where we expect the actual roots to be. So this is a plot of what the discriminant function D looks like as a function of frequency for a string of length 1 and a sound speed 1. Okay?
Yeah, no, I'm just thinking about what the potential error modes are of having 3 instead of 1. Does that mean that is that a catastrophic failure?
No, but you're going to miss 2 of those modes.
Yeah. Okay, and those are going to be, the modes I'm missing are going to be really high frequency modes?
Not necessarily.
No. So I'm just missing 2 modes.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, great. So in this plot here, we can just see by eyeballing it that the roots of the discriminant function, so the eigenfrequencies of the string are there, which I guess is sigma equals pi here, sigma equals 2 pi here, sigma equals 3 pi. So in fact, it's the standard, you know, the frequency is some integer multiple of pi that we know the modes on a string have to obey. But suppose we sample this function on a grid of frequencies that had some sort of weird distribution, where you can see we're sampling it really nicely here. So the red dots indicate our samples. And for instance, from here to here, these two, the discriminant has different signs here, so we know between here and here there's a root, and here, sure enough, here it is. But if we go further out and we look at this case here, the discriminant function's positive here, and at the next point it's positive, so we don't know, we actually miss this pair of modes. So you always miss modes in pairs, whether it's 2 at a time or 4 at a time. And this is kind of an egregious example I've chosen to highlight. What happens if the distribution of points at which you evaluate the discriminant really mismatches the actual distribution of the roots of the discriminant. Here's using a more sensible grid, which is uniformly spaced, but I've made it too low resolution. So you can see, for this root here, we bracket it nicely, but for this pair of roots here, the discriminant on either side of the pair has the same size, so we wouldn't realize there are actually a pair of roots in that interval, and we'd miss that pair.
So what's going to be the, from a standpoint of user, what am I going to see that's going to raise a flag for me?
You could see that the mode radial order skips by two or four, and that's usually a sure sign that you're not properly sampling.
I don't have enough, I'm not sampling dense enough.
You're not sampling dense enough. So if you do things right, you get something like this, which is uniform sampling to match the uniform distribution of roots in frequency space, and it's a high enough resolution that for every pair of points, you can unambiguously isolate whether there's a root there, or in this case, whether there's no root between them. Now, I bring this up because in the calculation we did in Jaya, we're not looking for p-modes, which are uniform in the asymptotic limit. P-modes have uniform spacing and frequency. But g-modes in the asymptotic limit of large radial order have uniform spacing and period, which is the inverse of frequency. So when we go fishing for g-modes, we have to scan uniformly, not in frequency space, but uniformly in inverse frequency or period space. And this is what the scan parameters do for our L equals 1 modes. They say scan between a minimum dimensionless frequency of 0.15 to up to a maximum of 0.45, but set up a grid that has a uniform spacing and inverse frequency and 100 points uniformly distributed in an inverse frequency. And that is vital when looking for G-modes, to have that grid type equals inverse rather than grid type equals linear. Ilva?
So how do you know how many you should put in this 100 thing?
What, these values?
Yeah.
It's to some extent trial and error. If you've got a broad sense of what sort of star you're working with, I know that typically low order, so n is, 5, 10, 20. When I say n, I mean the radial order of the modes. I know that G modes for an SBB star of lowish radial order inhabit that range of frequencies, and that's just because, I've been playing around with SBB stars a lot. But you can, if you make the minimum frequency lower, you will end up finding higher order G modes. And if you make the maximum frequency higher, you will end up finding lower order G modes. Because G modes live in the low frequency space, and as you go to lower frequencies, you get higher order G modes, i.e., ones that have more wiggles, higher overtones, as it were.
That's also the big advantage of working with dimensionless frequencies.
Yes.
Those numbers don't change if you change the mass of your star.
Yeah.
So if I put 0 to 1, I will be sure that I catch.
But you can't do 0 because remember it's setting up the grid in inverse frequency space, so inverse of 0.
0.0001.
But then you would end up finding modes that have very, very, very high radial order. And you would end up finding thousands and thousands of modes, but you're only sampling at 100 frequencies. So you would have to increase this as well. So really, it's like you're going fishing, and you've got to tune the parameters of the net to match the fish that you're planning to catch.
You just make an extremely wide range and extremely dense inlet fish.
Yeah.
Okay. So Richard, how do I also look at the same time for L equals 1 P modes?
What you would do is typically... you could put in another scan thing that had linear here and went from, let's say, 1 to 10. And what it would do is it would actually concatenate the frequency scans from the G mode one and the P mode one and would gather them together and then use that as its overall master grid. So you could have as many of these scans that you want as long as they match the tag of the mode you're wanting to affect. And they will just be all merged together. Duplicate points will be thrown out. But you can basically build up quite a complex scan of frequency space with different resolutions in different areas.
When I was using Jaya a few years ago, I had problems with the numbering of the frequencies at the low end, small n. Is that still the problem, or is that solved?
The numbering, do you mean the radial orders?
Yes.
Sometimes the radial orders have numbers that don't make sense. And that's either due to a breakdown of how we understand pulsations work, or it's due to a deficiency of the stellar model.
Well, no, it was due to just the wrong calculation of n.
Well,
so the way to solve that was to go from the high ends and then count, and then, you know.
There are some subtleties in creating unique radial orders for dipole modes that Masao Takada investigated. For dipole modes, there is no mode with a combined radial order of zero. And that is a consequence of momentum conservation. Or rather, the mode of radial order zero has a zero frequency because it's a uniform displacement of the star. So if you do a sequence of G modes and then carry on to the P mode sequence, if it's L equals 1 modes, it'll go minus 3, minus 2, minus 1, plus 1. It'll skip over that L, N equals 0.
Yeah, well,
Okay, so we're going to go back to our clamped string now, because we've talked a little bit about resolution and frequency space when we're scanning for these eigenfrequencies, but we've also got to make sure there's adequate resolution in actual real space, in physical space. So this is an illustration of some of the wave functions we get by solving our ODE for the clamped string. This is the fundamental, which I've labeled as N equals 1. I guess I could label it as N equals it. No, it is N equals 1, and if the frequencies are given by N pi, then the fundamental mode has a wave function that looks like this. This is the first overtone, and this is like the ninth overtone. Now, we were able to solve that ODE just analytically using math, but if we hadn't been able to do that, we would have had to do it numerically, and when we're solving a differential equation numerically, in fact, it's a two-point boundary value problem, we typically don't sample or don't represent our solutions on with an infinite resolution. They're always represented on a grid with finite resolution. So this is what the solutions would actually look like if we had some sort of finite resolution grid, and these are just like straight lines joining each segment. And, you know, we're still able to adequately resolve these three different wave functions, but if the resolution of our grid became too coarse, it would turn out that we're still kind of reasonably representing our fundamental and first overtone, but our ninth overtone, we've got a really bad spatial representation. We're basically under-resolving the spatial oscillations of the eigenfunction. And as a consequence, we do a really bad job of actually satisfying the governing differential equation. And that will end up screwing up our characteristic equation and our discriminant function.
Well, so that's why when you added points, it was based on your frequency search space.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Let me just finish over. So it's key, if you want a discriminant function that is meaningful and therefore can give you meaningful eigenfrequencies, you also need to make sure you have adequate spatial resolution so you can resolve the eigenfunctions. Ilva.
Yes. So x here is the spatial resolution, and your uh-huh. little dots is actually the number of zones that you have now, 1842.
Yes, that 1842 is the number of spatial zones. So I added a few extra to go up from 1814.
Yes. So if you will have instead like 10, as you put here, then we would have this problem, but 1842 is good.
Well, it depends on what mode you're looking at.
Okay.
For modes that have... It's possible for Jaya to calculate modes that have 1,000 oscillations between the center and the surface. Mm-hmm. And in that case, 1842 points wouldn't be quite enough to adequately resolve 1,000 wavelengths of a wave.
Of course, in terms of trying to reproduce physically what really is happening, right? So Gyre adds in these points where it needs them, but if the solution is produced by Meza, if you had to do that a lot,
yeah.
Right. That means that Meza was under resolved.
That's not necessarily true. I mean, let's say we have a region of the star that's
the solution variables. In that.
The solution of the underlying model, the smoothness of the underlying model is not necessarily. You can have an eigenfunction that is far less smooth than the underlying model. Or no, it's perfectly smooth, but it's incredibly oscillatory. Whereas the underlying model is not.
Yeah.
Right. And that's when you run into difficulties with resolution. And it's okay to carry on interpolating in the underlying model, because that is still very smooth.
Okay.
Step functions in the underlying model are going to be...
Well, so step functions in the underlying model are actually handled by replacing the difference equations with jump conditions. So in just the same way, you know, one could handle a shock by, when you get close to a shock, you don't mess around with your slope. You tell your slope limiters, no, this is a shock. You're not meant to, you know, try and jump up here.
So that's part of your importing a Mesa model, is to recognize places where you need jump conditions.
In fact, when we in recent versions of Mesa, when we export the model,
okay.
Mesa has already decided that a couple of cells have a big enough density difference that really is a jump, and so it writes out a double point at that interface, representing the densities on the inside and the outside of the discontinuity.
Rich owns the code on both sides of that interface, so it's kind of arbitrary whether it's done on the Mesa side or the gyre side.
Okay, so this is actually my last slide, which is quite well timed, because this is where I ran out of time when preparing stuff yesterday. But the grid nameless group allows you to set the criteria which govern when Gyre will insert extra points into the model in order to get a good enough spatial grid to resolve the modes it's going to find. There are three parameters you need to set, and these are always pretty good choices. So Alpha Osk says that in regions where we expect the solution to look oscillatory, make sure there are at least 10 points per wavelength of that oscillation. Okay. Alpha X says in regions where the solution is decaying or growing exponentially with position, make sure that there are at least 2 points per e-folding length of the growth or decay of the solution spatially. And then N-inner says, make sure you throw some points in at the center to adequately resolve the inner turning point of the equations, and that makes sure that the boundary conditions work properly. In nine times out of 10, when I'm doing a gyre run, I have these options. Now, if you don't put them in at all, they default to zero. So many times I've seen people running where they just leave grid blank, and they will end up with whatever grid the stellar evolution code thought was suitable, and often they end up just simulating rubbish, because they're not spatially resolving their eigenfunctions, so their frequencies are meaningless.
Keep following the minus one. Insistently.
I can set those as the new defaults. But,
yeah.
Depends on how many times you have to answer a question from a user that was based on the not changing.
There's a final couple of nameless groups in your input file. One is called add output, and that governs output from the adiabatic portion of the code. So the Gyre, when it's doing non-adiabatic calculations, will always first find the adiabatic oscillation frequencies of the star, and then it will use those as initial guesses to do the non-adiabatic ones. And you can get output written out at each stage. In the sample input file that you're using at the moment, only add output is defined, and that says write out various bits of information to a text file called summary.txt when you complete. So as well as printing the frequencies out to the screen, they can be written to file. You can also actually get Gyre to write out the wave functions, the eigenfunctions as well for different modes. And Gyre can both do sort of an ASCII format that's based on the same logical sort of file layout that Mesa uses for its profiles and logs. So it's a header line followed by a sequence of records. Or Gyre can output files in HDF5 format, which saves on disk space and is a nice self-describing format. Maria.
I guess moving on a little bit from using it, I was wondering, can you tell us a little bit about what types of problems we shouldn't try to use Gyre to do?
In principle, there's nothing that it shouldn't be able to do.
Okay.
There's no type of star that should be too horrendous for Gyre to cope with. But if you start if you're doing non-adiabatic calculations, the quality of the results is certainly, in terms of how well converged they are, is probably It's far more challenging to get non-adiabatic results to converge properly. And so I'm always a little bit more suspicious of non-adiabatic results than adiabatic ones. There was a recent case of a user who posted to the Jaya forums who was getting these crazy results, these non-adiabatic results, and he was looking at modes with radial order of 2,000. Now, that was just bullshit. You know, the numbers he was looking at were completely numerical. I wouldn't, for the non-adiabatic portion of the code, don't trust anything with a radial order above a few hundred.
And it was the original first slide point about hydrostatic equilibrium.
Yes.
If your MESA model is way out of hydrostatic equilibrium, we don't even...
Or like a very convective envelope.
So in the non-adiabatic portion in MESA, Jaya doesn't include the convection pulsation coupling. So it won't, for instance, get the red edge of the Cepheid instability strip correct, even though it can put the blue edge in the right place. And so for stars in which convection is very important in the envelope, I mean, this is really a failing of pulsation theory rather than Jaya per se. And one of the next big projects is to actually put that in there and try and do a better job. Ilva.
Where is the output?
The output is written to a file that will be called summary.txt. If you look at the input file, we actually say what output we want to write to.
Okay, so I'm there. So uh-huh. Can I make a periodogram of these?
You would have to probably write a little Python wrapper to read it in.
Yeah, that's okay. But
yeah, but you could make a periodogram. And you could look at the period spacings, and you would notice for this star that there's some modulation in the period spacing, indicating that it's got a molecular weight gradient zone.
Nice.
So the star is somewhat evolved.
So can you see the amplitude of the frequencies as well?
No, because this is a linear pulsation code, so the amplitude is completely unconstrained.
Okay.
So we don't know what amplitude the modes will have. We just know what frequencies they are.
To get excitation information.
Yes.
Basically,
are unstable, and you can find out the linear growth rates.
So can I, in some way, like see which mode is the important mode? Then, if you don't have that,
you can't. And this is a major puzzle in theory of stellar oscillations for heat-driven oscillations. Often, we will predict theoretically that thousands of modes are unstable and should grow in amplitude. But often when we make observations, we'll only see a few hundred or maybe 10 or sometimes just one. And it's not clear what physical process. Growth rate isn't necessarily a good indication of which is the mode that will end up with the highest amplitude.
Okay.
So, you know, that really is a place where we're still really scrambling around trying to come up with a comprehensive theory for what decides. It's called the mode selection problem. Even though thousands of modes are unstable, only a few tens may be excited to detectable amplitudes. Why is that? We don't know.
So if I would make a crazy MESA model and mm-hmm. I want to check, like, maybe this star is pulsating,
uh-huh.
Yeah, I could basically make it pulsate because I
search... So you would find frequencies, but if you're doing just an adiabatic calculation, that'll just tell you the frequencies at which the star would vibrate if you kicked it hard, mm-hmm. Okay? But it doesn't actually tell you whether out in the wild that star would naturally be oscillating in those frequencies. To do that, you have to do a non-adiabatic calculation, which will tell you whether some of the modes are damped and they will always decay away, or whether some are unstable and they'll actually grow exponentially from a tiny amplitude up to a visible amplitude. So the non-adiabatic calculations, Jaya can do those as well, and it'll tell you which modes are unstable and therefore you would see in a star without having to kick it.
And that is reliable?
It's reliable in all of the, for most of the cases it's been tested in. It won't work for the red edge of the Cepheid strip, but it's reliable for beta Cephei stars, it's reliable for SBB stars, it's reliable for gamma dwarf, well actually no, not for gamma dwarf stars, but that's a different issue. It's reliable.
That's great.
It's as reliable as everything else out there.
Some people are using
it's even more reliable, I would say.
MESA plus Jaya to astroseismology, trying to fit observed.
They are just doing adiabatic calculations. They don't care about whether the mode is stable or unstable because these aren't heat-driven modes they would be looking at. If they're doing RGBs, they're stochastically excited modes. So you only do adiabatic calculations for those anyway.
Great.
Okay. Okay. I should yield the stage.
Radial pulsations.
What about them?
If you decide, oh, this would be cool, let's go up and do Cepheids or R ladders. Don't bother. the Mesa currently, this is a Mesa star problem rather than a gyre issue. We do fine in terms of dealing with large amplitude radial pulsations driven by the iron bond, but when you go down to our library, you're dealing with helium ionization issues, and you go to septenial, classical septenes, you're down to high addition. For some reason, the current implementation in Mesa on those kills off the oscillations.
Just to clarify what Ben is saying, Mesa can actually do hydrodynamical simulations of radial pulsations, which is a far more complicated problem than gyres.
You
don't even do radial because it's a spherically symmetric.
The idea is if you wanted to, you could use use gyre to pick out a location, maybe at the terminal H main sequence if it's some of the big luminous guys are way over in the red if it's a classical septet, and then once you pick a place, then you want to say, okay, now if I just turn the Mesa loose there and force it to take very small time steps, what happens? And over on the blue side, what happens is that Mesa nicely grows these pulsations using the Kappa mechanism, which is really cool. Over on the other side, it just says, meow, and it just dies out. Instead of growing, something's killing Kappa. It's a mystery murder mystery. It needs to be solved.
So Gyre says it should be unstable, but Mesa can't find it.
For some reason, with the helium bump and hydrogen bump, we're failed. The Kappa mechanism is breaking down in Mesa, whereas it seems to work okay.
We'll be back.
Don't know why.
Sorry, Tom. Charming off your stage.
No, sorry.
Thank you, Rich.
I'm going to go to something my phone.